So our final speaker of this session is Carol Smith, a retired professor from Charlotte Mason Institute. And you're not going to use all the high-tech stuff, right? You're just going to use a language, right? Thank you.
Use the English language. So I think it's about time to get started. That transition happened really quickly. It's a completely different topic, so get ready for something that's totally different than the two presentations you've just seen. I'm going to talk about children and the teaching of science to children according to an educator who lived a long time ago. She, in fact, died in 1923. Her name was Charlotte Mason. There's a large homeschool movement and school movement using Charlotte Mason's ideas, which were started back in 1984 and a little before that by Susan Schaefer Macaulay, Francis Schaefer's daughter, who wrote a book called For the Children's Sake that set off a movement interested in Charlotte Mason's ideas. So I'm going to talk about two things. One thing that Mason had to say to teachers and parents about science, and number two, a few things that she had to say about the teaching of science to children. She had a lot to say, and I can, in this very short period of time, can only deal with just a few of them. So I'm going to stay pretty close to my text because I tend to be random. And I don't think you want that. So here we go. First part that I'm going to talk about are teachers and parents and what Mason wanted them to know and to think more or less philosophically about science. Whatever one's views are on Adam and Eve, I think a long, long time ago, as humankind was changing into what we are today, Adam was spending much more time outdoors than he was indoors. Did he feel himself a part of the natural world? Did he see himself as a friend of the animals or an enemy of the animals around him? Maybe not so much a friend or an enemy, but maybe one of them. I've not studied this relationship between Adam and Eve to understand precisely what it was, but it seems, though, logically, that because their lives were much more outdoors than ours are today, that Adam and Eve felt themselves to be much more connected to the outside world or the physical world. They were a part of it rather than being separated from it. In other words, they were participants with all the rest of nature and not just an objective observer of the physical world. It seems to me that we have consistently removed ourselves from this world and have become more and more an observer rather than a participant. Unlike Adam and Eve, our goal is to not feel the heat in summer nor the cold in winter. And of course, this makes sense. But as we have secluded ourselves further and further from the natural world, have we lost our relationship with that world? Are we just observers or are we participants? In fact, I am not sure that we even understand at this point in history what it means to be in relationship with the physical world. Even now, and even more, does the general American culture even consider such a thought? It seems that we, at this point in history, feel very separated from the physical world, that we stand almost in opposition to it rather than living in it as a participant. Much like Aristotle's science led to the Enlightenment, Plato's Earth as a dustbin of existence has made a far greater impact than we want to think. Nature, the physical world, it's out there. And we are in here, and never shall the two mix. We want to escape this physical world or this this dustbin. This is why we feel so comfortable with education or with school being in a building. And because of this thinking, many Americans cannot fathom being outside in the world. And hence, climate change is out there. And we are in here, away from even the beauty of the world and away from the problems that are out there. We are so disconnected from this outside world and so take it for granted that the idea of spending time in nature or developing a relationship with nature is quite a novel idea. And I suggest that the problem is the way we teach science. Why do people see the Earth as an object to be studied, an object separated from them like Plato's dustbin? The idea of having a relationship with the Earth, with trees and flowers and bushes, streams, seems impossible because we cannot imagine having a relationship with anything other than another human being. And interestingly, as we have distanced ourselves from the physical world, in fact, we seem to be distancing ourselves from one another. The physical world, like the universe, is something that we study and learn about for what we can get from it, even the saving of our own existence. Now, for sure, a relationship with the physical world is different than a relationship with our fellow image bearers. Yet, are we to exist on this planet without some way of knowing it and being known by it? This lack of relationship with the physical world was contrary to Charlotte Mason's view of teaching science. Now remember, she is an educationalist who deals with the learning of children in the early years. In fact, she worked in a school initially that it was a British infant school that where she taught children from two years old up to seven. So remember, she's thinking children here and young people. But she says, we are anxious not to make science a utilitarian subject. Thus, children in a Mason paradigm are never to study science for utilitarian purposes. They are to see science, especially in their early years, as a study of the development of humankind. Not only are they to learn science proper, but they are to learn about great scientists. Now, fancy the next one. They are to learn about their struggles, their failures, their successes. She says, the heroes of science should be their heroes. The great names, especially of those who are amongst us, should be household words. How many scientists in our culture are household names in a family? They are to know the story of the development of science, not just science itself, because Mason wanted children to have a love for God's earth, a relationship with God's earth. And not just information about science or the earth that they could use for their own utilitarian ends. So parents and teachers were to teach with these ideas in mind. But inspiration by the great stories of the heroes of science was not enough. Just as science was to be about relationship, so science was to produce a highly skilled person who was inspired by that relationship with science. She says it well. It is well that enthusiasm of children should be kindled, that they should see how glorious it is to devote a lifetime to patient research, how great to find out a single secret of nature, a key to many riddles. So taking time, not being in a hurry, pass the test, observing details slowly and methodically, these are ways of learning that we seem to have forgotten as we have moved indoors. She had another thought for parents and teachers. She says, let us first of all settle it with ourselves that science and religion cannot, to the believer in God by any possibility be antagonistic. Having assured ourselves of this, she says, we shall probably go on to perceive that the evolution of science is in fact a process of revelation. We see then that just as science should be about relationship with the physical world and about skillfulness, Mason also wanted children and adults to understand that science was a continuous revelation to humankind. Because of these ideas, she coined a phrase called the science of relations. That is, children should have many relationships: family, neighborhood, community, God's creation, people from the past, people from the present. And she categorized these relationships in three domains. One, knowledge of God, knowledge of the universe, which includes all your sciences and mathematics, and knowledge of humankind, which includes the humanities. But how does she want children to be taught these? So let's talk about that for a few minutes. Why is the science of relations for children important? And here we begin to get at how Mason wanted to teach children. Because of her belief that education was about relationship and not power, she wanted parents to begin a young child's education outdoors. Starting very early, she says, in home education, set the child to definite work by all means and give him something to grind, but pray let him work with things and not with signs. The things of nature in their own places, meadow and hedgerow, wood and shore. And again, she says, it would be well if all persons in authority, parents and those who act for parents, could make up their minds that there is no sort of knowledge to be got in these early years so valuable to children as that which they can get for themselves of the world they live in. Let them get in touch with nature, and a habit is formed which will be a source of delight through life. I just touched the wrong thing here, and a whole bunch of stuff disappeared. Hang on just a minute. We jumped a whole bunch of paragraphs here. That's interesting. Okay. Let them get in touch with nature, and a habit is formed which will be a source of delight through life. We were all meant to be naturalists, each in his own degree. And it is inexcusable to live in a world so full of marvels of plant and animal life and to care for none of these things. Again, she says, set him face to face with a thing and he is 20 times as quick as you are in knowing about it. Knowledge of things flies to the mind of a child as steel filings to a magnet. In this process of having direct access to things, Mason was developing the child's relationship with the outdoors, or she was developing what she referred to as the science of relations. When the relationship with the outdoors is developed for years, even before the child starts to school, the relationship with the outdoor world becomes deeper and more intimate. Compare that with our world today, where so many children know nothing of the outdoors. Why should they care about climate change, other than to save their own necks? The earth is purely a dustbin, is it not, for them? That thinking is even in the church. Down the road from where I live, I've heard well-known pastors talk about that it's all going to burn anyway. So why care? In a Mason paradigm, children grow up with the idea that the world around us is, in a sense, sacred. It is worthy of our attention. It is worthy of our caring for it. So what are some of the other ways that Mason had for teaching science? And I wanted to mention this one specifically in front of scientists. Science books had to be living. That is, they were to be written not as textbooks full of information, devoid of a soul. They were to be written by authors who loved the topic so much so that the student could feel and hear the love of the topic coming through in the text of the book. These books were to be written by someone who was living on this planet, engaged with this planet, much as I said at the beginning with Adam and Eve. In other words, by scientists who do not feel themselves divorced or somehow feel like some objective observer of the universe, and neither the observer nor the observed have a soul. These kinds of writers engage the minds of children and are necessary for inspiration and motivation and for leading children into a love of the sciences. And as regarding the writing of texts, they need to be so well written that they are called literary texts. That is, that they are simple, elegant, delightful, and providing children with a language that will invite them into the Garden of Eden. So what's another example of how Mason wanted children taught? Children were to keep what she referred to as nature notebooks, in which they made drawings and special studies of things that they were interested in. For example, they might observe the same spot in nature for a full year, draw it, and make notes about it to observe how it changed throughout the year. Another one, science was to be taught in an integrated way so that children, again, see the relationship and the connections. And I just want to point that out by giving you a list of exam questions for one set of students. And listen to these exam questions that all relate to what Mason perceived as science. Make a rough sketch of a section of ditch or hedge or seashore and put in the names of the plants you would expect to find. That's one. Two, write notes with drawings of the special study you made this term. Three, what do you understand by calyx, corella, stamen, or pistil? In what ways are flowers fertilized? How would you find the North Star? Mention six other stars and say in what constellation they occur. How would you distinguish between early, decorated, and perpendicular Gothic? Give drawings. Questions like these, it will be seen, cover a good deal of field work and study of some half dozen carefully selected books on natural history, botany, architecture, and astronomy, the principle being that children shall observe and chronicle, but shall not depend on their own unassisted observation. So with these questions, what are some things that we can note? First, field study in a Mason education is extraordinarily important. Staying inside of a building all the time was not for her education. She wanted children to get their hands into the physical world. She also did not want to isolate science by itself. So you notice architecture, and there are other places where there's art, there's architecture, and there's this blending of art and science. Notice that there are books from professionals that children refer to and not just their own observations. But also notice that children were to choose special topics of their own interest. One of her major principles of education is that the child is a born person. He's an image bearer. He needs dominion. So he gets to choose some of his own topics. Notice some very specific science in terms of plants, the stamen, the corella, the calyx, those sorts of things. Notice how Mason's model of education, if you listen carefully, is self-directed. It's not top-down directed. In other words, children learn from within, not from without. And that is another whole lecture that takes you in a completely different direction for education. But she was very keen on natural history and botany being studied throughout the school life, whereas other sciences were studied term by term. Frequently, three or four sciences were studied each term, term by term, so that kids could see the connection between the two. But history and natural history and botany were taught throughout school life. In other words, being an observer of the natural world was to be a lifelong habit. Mason did not want education to be in a building. It was to be a way of living. She says that nature notebooks become traveling companions and life records. The nature notebook is very Catholic and finds room for the stars, for a fossil. It finds interest, finds place for things of many different interests. Certainly, these nature notebooks do a good deal to bring science within the range of common thought and experience, which actually she got from Huxley. And then she says, we are anxious not to make science a utilitarian subject. If you know something about Victorian life, you will recognize the idea of having a nature notebook as a Victorian thought. But I think this idea of guiding children into a deeper relationship with the outside world through observation simply increases their chance of exploring various sciences and moving forward with this love of the outside world into a career in science. How can we otherwise get children interested in something that they have no relationship with? Okay, I think my time is probably getting short, so just a couple of things I want to say here. Mason defined education in a number of different ways, but I found this particular definition that she gave rather interesting. Education might be defined as a deliberate adjustment of a growing human being to its environment. And the scope and character of the subjects of instruction should be determined by this biological principle. What was best for one race or epoch need not be best for another. The essential mission of school science was to prepare students for civilized citizenship by revealing to them something of the beauty and the power of the world in which they lived, as well as introducing them to the methods by which the boundaries of natural knowledge had been extended. She says, school science, therefore, was not intended to prepare for vocations, but to equip children to live life. And I'd like to end with one last quote by Charlotte Mason. In the speaking of teaching science to children, where science does not teach a child to wonder and to admire, it perhaps has no educative value. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. We have a few minutes for questions.
How were Mason's ideas regarded at the time?
At the time of her life, there was quite a large following, but it wasn't the major part of the British people. You know, there were probably 300 or 400 public schools. They call them government schools. Their public schools are actually private schools, but there were 200 or 300 government schools, number of private schools. But she died in 1923 when governesses were going out of use, and she initially started her school to prepare governesses to teach children in the home. So, in it, although she very much wanted her ideas out there for everyone, a lot of the people who used her ideas were wealthy individuals. Now, there are examples of where there were some radical changes in very poor schools. They were coal mining schools. There are some stories about those in the archive where it just radically changed the school. So there's evidence that it was used across the board, but the main use of her ideas was in the educated classes in England.
Other questions?
How widely and how is it implemented here in the United States?
After Susan Schaefer-McCauley wrote her book in 1984, it slowly was picked up by homeschool parents.
Okay.
Today, there are a number of schools increasingly beginning to use it. Yeah. And you will also see this mixture out there, and this is, I'll just make this statement and end it there, of Charlotte Mason Classical School. So there's this kind of...
somewhat identified as.
Yeah. With, yeah. But Charlotte Mason was not a classical. Yes.
So what is, like, if let's say this were to be adopted or become widespread, at the same time we have urban areas, like populations are leaving rural areas and going into these mm-hmm. urban areas, and they're more and more being taken away from this natural environment. So how would you think, like, how, what are your ideas for how the Charlotte Mason thing could be integrated into an urban environment?
My first thought would be, this is why we really have to push cities to have parks. Number one, number two, we learn to do a lot of gardening in pots. We learn to use balconies. We learn to use windows. We learn to use whatever. Wherever we are, we adapt and make adjustments.
Your comments remind me of an article that I read in the Consumer's Report on Health, a little monthly flyer they put out, where they talked about the psychological and physiological advantages of spending 15, 20 minutes each day outside in contact with nature. Not exercise, although exercise mm-hmm. is good. It doesn't have to be exercise, just in contact with nature.
Yeah.
And of course, when it's 94, I'm not sure I like that, but other days it's not too bad. Any other questions?
Yes, sir. So, how do some of these educational principles apply to secondary or post-secondary education? Or is this
well,
more
someone else asked that question earlier today. It does. Yeah. However, again, Mason looked at, and we look at today, the developmental stages of children. Mm-hmm. So the early years are very story-oriented. You know, actually, about 13, 14, there's a developmental change. Mm-hmm. And we recognize it in many schools as middle school and high school. So it's usually about the end of ninth grade that begins to be a shift in children's abstract abilities, and then they begin to be more keen toward more difficult things. Mm-hmm. They're more able to understand chemistry purely as chemistry and the technical things about chemistry than they are before that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So. Yeah. Even with that, Mason wanted those subjects to run together through high school because of the relationship issue. She didn't want a kid, okay, I took chemistry this semester, check it off, I'm finished, I don't ever have to look at chemistry again. She wanted them to see the whole importance and relationship of chemistry to the whole of life. But about that age, children began to develop interest, and you can see them sometimes, not always, moving more toward I like algebra, I like math, or I like science, I like literature, I like. So they began. Do you understand what I'm? Mm-hmm. Is that answering your question?
Yeah.
Because even in high school, in about 12th grade, in the Mason paradigm, you began to not push, but encourage kids more toward independent study. What is it you want to know?
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to study? Where are you headed? What do you think? You know those kinds of things. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, I'm a biologist, and field courses are my favorite paradigm.
Yeah.
To teach.
Yeah.
The learning that goes on there is remarkable. It's contextual. The wonder of it all.
Yeah.
Very good. Any other questions? Let's thank Carol again.
Thank you.
My schedule says we have a break.